You are a citizen of the rural county seat of Adams County, Pennsylvania, Gettysburg. It's late July of 1863. The grand battle has come and gone, and in its wake, thousands of bodies. Under the hot summer sun, the bodies have bloated. Many have burst. Biblical swarms of flies descend on the town and surrounding fields. You'd never seen buzzards in town before, but with the great calamity of the past battle's carrion, you see them in droves, soaring overhead or plucking at the body's stringy, rotten meat. Teams of men work to identify Union bodies. Others work to bury Confederates where they lay, if at all possible. You've heard stories that particularly jaded neighbors have tossed carcasses between the rocks at Devil's Den, and to remove them later, used hooks and scythes to pull them up in pieces. At home, a general smell of death and rot pervades the air. Gettysburg's civilians seem sickly at all times. You use mint oil, as many of the town's ladies have suggested, by rubbing under your nose in an attempt to mask the smell. Day after day, you can see the recovery efforts of the town. Wagons of decomposing Union bodies are moved to find more proper places of rest for the heroes of the North. Confederate graves are small, barely a foot under the dirt. Already there are ghost stories circling about the town's children. Out in the fields by Oak Hill and Ridge, they point at the debris and effects of soldiers, and run off screaming as they find hands, arms emerging from the soil after a rain. It seems that the hell of war lingers on, and will, far after it closes. One day, you and a few others from your street volunteer to start moving bodies. It is not a task you wish to take up, but you feel compelled that, as a good human and a citizen of Gettysburg, it's your duty to help. You walk with some of the ladies and men in your street. "God help us and help the dead," one mutters. "I hear tell of a cemetery being made for our boys," a man adds. "The camp out west, Camp Letterman, that massive tent hospital, demands it," you say. The other lady says softly, "All those bodies, even after the battle." Through the day, you help gather Union dead and put them onto wagons. They head towards the bald grass on the northwestern face of Cemetery Hill, behind the Evergreen Cemetery with its brick gatehouse just visible and marked with the scars of battle. On this day, you are contributing to the first acts of preservation on the Gettysburg battlefield. This is Days of Yore, a history podcast. As always, I'm your host, Joe. In today's episode, we'll be talking about the preservation of the battlefield at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Its long history, how it was achieved, and what it means to us today. I'll try to go over some of the main points in brief and not to keep this episode incredibly long. The history of Gettysburg's preservation is almost too long to fully account for, but in today's episode we will hit the highlights and talk about some interesting stories and what preservation really means to the modern American. Four score and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. These are the opening lines of President Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, delivered on November 19, 1863, to consecrate the opening of the Soldiers' National Cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, for the dead at the Battle of Gettysburg. But of course, this famous speech would not be if there had been no Gettysburg Cemetery to boast of. So, as one of the early preservation movements, and one of the early movements to have a national place of remembering and a national sort of memorial at Gettysburg, is the creation of this cemetery. Of course, after the battle, as we discussed a little bit in the opening, there was a lot of dead bodies lying around Gettysburg. Now, the Confederates were buried where they were found, if they could be, and or put together in a line and buried that way, but the Union soldiers were cared for a little more gently, so to speak, and they were gathered and sort of collected into a place to be formally buried. While some bodies were buried in other towns nearby, where they may have come from, or where there were openings in cemeteries, they were eventually dug back up and moved to the Soldiers' National Cemetery. But it was Gettysburg attorneys David McConaughey and David Wills who began working on a cemetery project, backed by a local man of repute, a local historian, local illustrator named John Badger Batchelder, Batchelder was an early preservationist himself and was very interested in the memorialization of Gettysburg as a place and what that would mean not only for contemporary Americans at his time, but for Americans in the future, to sort of cement Gettysburg as a place of honor and remembrance. Now, there's a funny story that John Badger Batchelder, one of his sort of first initial things he wanted to preserve was the copse of trees on Cemetery Ridge. The copse of trees, of course, marked the center of the Union line at the Battle of Gettysburg, and it was used as a sort of landmark for the Confederates to use in the battle to come. And of course, the copse of trees was made most famous by Pickett's Charge, which was the fighting on the third day at the Battle of Gettysburg, at least a portion of the fighting on the third day at the Battle of Gettysburg. It was targeted by Robert E. Lee, and he said, this is the center of the line, and we will attack, and attacked. And these men sort of marched themselves into the pages of American history. So John Batchelder, he was walking along Cemetery Ridge one day, and he came across the copse of trees, and he saw people cutting down trees. He saw people taking branches out of the trees for firewood. And he had a little bit of a confrontation with these local civilians of Gettysburg and said, hey, whoa, like, this is really important. You got to pump the brakes a little bit. This is an important piece of American history and Gettysburg's history. And of course, the people were like, yeah, so what, whatever. And they sort of went back to it. But he's like, sort of ended up convincing them to leave the copse of trees alone for at least a little bit. The copse of trees, of course, is still there, but there are no witness trees. Most of them have either died or been, as we hear from that story, chopped down. But Batchelder was sort of the first guy on the job. He wrote to Andrew Curtin, who was the wartime governor of Pennsylvania, and said, we need a cemetery, a place of remembrance, a memorialization at Gettysburg for our fallen dead. Andrew Curtin, he was, of course, the governor of Pennsylvania, as I mentioned, but also he was Lincoln's sort of, like, right-hand man as far as the governors of the North go. Andrew Curtin was ready to support Lincoln at any cause. He convened a meeting to vote on the support of the Emancipation Proclamation in Altoona, Pennsylvania in 1862. Of course, there were other things to be discussed, but that was one of the big ones, was support for the Emancipation Proclamation. Andrew Curtin continually rallied support amongst Northern governors for Abraham Lincoln during the war, and Pennsylvania contributed the second or third most men to the Union cause during the Civil War. So Andrew Curtin, of course, was very eager to, you know, give the thumbs up to this project. And of course, Batchelder, working with David Willis and David McConaughey, these local attorneys, he sort of put them to the task of organizing this. So Willis hired one William Saunders, who was a renowned horticulturalist, landscape architect, and the Department of Agriculture's first botanist, to sort of take on the job of designing a cemetery. Now, what Saunders designed is the cemetery we're familiar with today. It's sort of a obtuse angle on Cemetery Hill, and the graves, not all, are raised above the ground. They're sort of a large semicircle divided into sections of states, and the tombs are flat along the ground. And of course, many of them are labeled unknown, but many others are equivalently labeled with identification. And it was thanks to the efforts of Gettysburg civilians who gathered these men prior to the dedication and creation of the cemetery and were able to identify some of them that these graves sort of came into existence. And as I said, the dedication of this cemetery took place in November 19th, 1863. And Edward Everett, who is a public lecturer well known across the country, attended, and he was sort of the centerpiece of the event. He spoke for hours before Abraham Lincoln. Andrew Curtin, of course, was in attendance. Lincoln was there, most notably, but Lincoln was actually sort of an afterthought. People closer to the time of the dedication in Gettysburg said, we should invite the president to this. This would be a big deal. And of course, the famous story is that, you know, Everett speaks for 2.5 hours, being a public lecturer and orator, and he makes numerous allusions to ancient history and the greatness of battle and soldiers who fell in battle in the past. And then Lincoln stands up and he reads a speech for 2.5 minutes. And Everett, after the speech, comes up and approaches the president and says, you said more in 2.5 minutes than I have said in 2.5 hours of speaking. Everett makes reference to the grounds around them as a place of sort of symbolic of Valhalla, of Nordic myth. But Abraham Lincoln makes the cemetery mean something far more new, even, if you think about it. Abraham Lincoln says that when we consecrate this ground, we turn the page in the chapter of this national crisis, of this civil war, and we make the war about something new. It is a new birth of freedom, perhaps not for the white citizens of the United States, but for the enslaved citizens of the states in rebellion, and in the North even, perhaps not enslaved, but escaped slavery and free black folk. The Civil War was now most certainly about the liberation of not only states in rebellion, but of those people enslaved in those states. Lincoln sets forth this new birth of freedom. At Gettysburg, and while not mentioned, Vicksburg, is the turning point of the Civil War, not only strategically, but politically and philosophically. The Gettysburg Address changes the tune of the Civil War to something about more than politics, more than the capture of rebelling land, and into something far more American. That is liberation and freedom. And we get to have that speech, that integral moment in American history, because these folks, David Wills, David McConaughey, John Badger Batchelder, and their hired landscape architect William Saunders, and the support of not only Andrew Curtin, but the people of Pennsylvania and the people of Gettysburg, to have the cemetery, we get to have that important, important moment in the history of America, the Gettysburg Address, this almost impromptu moment that occurred over the course of a few weeks, thanks to the creation and preservation of this part of Gettysburg as a memorial landscape, as a piece of public memory. Now, it's important to note that David McConaughey was born and raised in Gettysburg. He was one of these two men that helps in the creation of the cemetery. And he does more than just the creation of the cemetery for Gettysburg as a memorial landscape, as a place of preservation, because he is one of the founders of the GBMA, the Gettysburg Battlefield Memorial Association. And the GBMA, what they do is they are sort of, they lead the charge, essentially, in monumenting the battlefield, allowing veteran groups to come back to Gettysburg and put up a monument on the battlefield. They start early tours of the battlefield. They look at early preservation methods, and if not preservation methods, then at the very least, sort of memorialization efforts on the battlefield at Gettysburg. And David McConaughey, part of this commission to create the cemetery, also creates the GBMA and kickstarts the memorialization of Gettysburg and the monumentation of Gettysburg. As we think about Gettysburg and its preservation, I think it's also important to think about Gettysburg's purpose as a place. Now, what I mean by this is that I think looking at the environmental history and the preservation history of Gettysburg is important. I think it is understudied, and the studies that are out about it are perhaps deemed like the end-all be-all of studies on Gettysburg's preservation and environmental history. However, I think these go hand in hand with looking at Gettysburg as a place of not only culture and history, but as well memory. And I really want to focus in on that word memory. What is memory? Well, rationally speaking, or logically thinking about the word memory, memory is what we remember. Memory is the idiosyncrasy, the peculiarity person to person of what they remember from the past. Now, memory can be a shaky thing. It's a shaky place to operate, especially in regards to history. However, I think memory is very important. While one person can remember an event completely differently from another, as every person's experiences are individual, that in itself does not need to detract from memory and history. We put a lot of stake in memory, anyways, if you think about it. World War II veteran interviews are wildly popular, and especially as that generation is passing away, in the past two, three, four decades even, we have been desperately
interviewing these people to collect their stories through oral histories. But as well, we have to keep in mind that this is their memory. This is not chiseled in stone fact, gospel truth, capital T truth. It is only what they remember. It's idiosyncratic, person to person. It is unique and different, and details will vary place to place. However, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to read to you a quote by French thinker Pierre Nora about memory and history. Quote, "Memory and history, far from being synonymous, appear now to be in fundamental opposition. Memory is life, born by living societies, founded in its name. It remains in permanent evolution, open to the dialectic of remembering and forgetting, unconscious of its successive deformations, vulnerable to manipulation and appropriation, susceptible to being long dormant and periodically revived. History, on the other hand, is the reconstruction, always problematic and incomplete, of what is no longer. Memory is a perpetually actual phenomenon, a bond tying us to the eternal present. History is a representation of the past. Memory, insofar as it is effective and magical, only accommodates those facts that suit it. It nourishes recollections that may be out of focus or telescopic, global or detached, particular or symbolic, responsive to each avenue of conveyance or phenomenal screen, to every censorship or projection. History, because it is an intellectual and secular problem, calls for analysis and criticism. Memory installs remembrance within the sacred. History, always prosaic, releases it again. Memory is blind to all but the group it binds, which is to say that there are as many memories as there are groups, that memory is by nature multiple and yet specific, collective, plural, and yet individual. History, on the other hand, belongs to everyone and to no one, whence its claim to universal authority. Memory takes root in the concrete, in spaces, gestures, images, and objects. History binds itself strictly to temporal continuities, to progressions, and to relations between things. Memory is absolute, while history can only conceive the relative. At the heart of history is a critical discourse that is antithetical to spontaneous memory. History is perpetually suspicious of memory, and its true mission is to suppress and destroy it. At the horizon of historical societies, at the limits of the completely historicized world, there would occur a permanent secularization. History's goal and ambition is not to exalt, but to annihilate what has in reality taken place. A generalized critical history would no doubt preserve some museums, some medallions and monuments, that is to say, the materials necessary for its work, but it would empty them of what to us would make them places of memory. In the end, a society living wholly under the sign of history could not, any more than could a traditional society, conceive such sites for anchoring its memory." So that was kind of a mouthful, and I apologize for reading such a long quote, but I think it's a really important quote, and also a really fantastically written one. So what is Pierre Nora trying to say here? I'll sort of hone in on the memory parts while trying to summarize this. I think what Nora is trying to suggest is that memory is, if anything, more important than history. And I don't think he's saying hardline that that's the case. But he does make a pretty good case, if not a good case, then a sharp one, against a world based on the quantifiable, sort of data-driven history set, if you will. That is to say that the sort of agency and spiritualism even of the past is removed from it when it is looked at purely historically. That taking out memory removes the agency of not only the people of the past but of the present who have potentially remembered an event or remember things about an event that even they weren't there for. Not to say that they've been imbued with some past life information, but their experience with understanding an event, going to the place it happened, so on and so forth. He says that history is not really a thing that has a place outside of a university or a textbook, a museum or a monument, whereas memory has places. Memory exists outside of the imagination, outside of the mind, that there are places where memory is anchored physically to the past. So what does this have to do with Gettysburg? What does this have to do with us and our topic today of both preservation and of memory and place? Well, what I really want to exemplify here is that memory is important, and I've said that already, but what to sort of expound on that is that Gettysburg is not a place that existed from July 1st, 1863 to November 19th, 1863 when Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address. It existed before, beyond, and after that. Obviously, we can go to Gettysburg today, it's still there, the town's still there, the battlefield is still there, so on and so forth. Of course, that's obvious. But what I mean to say with this is that Gettysburg has a history beyond the history that it is normally associated with. Of course, you could talk about the town's history and local people's history, sort of taking a local history approach to Gettysburg outside of the larger national narrative or moments and movements, so on, and look at Gettysburg's preservation, its environmental history, its impact on memory. Those of us who have visited Gettysburg, those of us who have heard of Gettysburg or learned of Gettysburg, have a memory associated with the place, even if we haven't been there. Our memory influences, to some aspect, the understanding of what Gettysburg is and was. My going to Gettysburg as a child and being inspired by it manipulates, to some aspect, the understanding of Gettysburg, at least to those people who interact with me or who listen to this podcast. My being there, my memories of this place interact with not only the landscape and the environment, but of the study of Gettysburg, the understanding of what Gettysburg is. And Gettysburg has meant a lot of different things to a lot of different people from the moment the battle started to the present day. For a soldier on the battlefield, it could mean life or death. It could mean a grand story to take home to your family. It could mean the end of your military career. A lot of units were mustered out just before, just after Gettysburg. It could mark a point in your life where, if you were mustered out just before the Battle of Gettysburg in May of 1863, and you hear about this battle happening, and your unit would have been there, and you may have known where you would have been on the battlefield if you were there at that point, if you were still in the service. And you may have died in that battle. You may have literally dodged a bullet, in essence. And that might mean something to you, and you take that with you. Or if you're at the Battle of Gettysburg, being on the battlefield, you associate memories with individual places, with the battle itself, with the people around you, the people you're fighting, the trees, the rocks, the actual environment. Your memory is imbued into that place in some aspect, and it has an importance and has a staying power that we care about still to this day. It is anchored in a place of memory. In David Glassberg's 2001 book, Sense of History, The Place of Past in American Life, he talks about this idea of place and placelessness. But I'm going to focus in on place first and foremost. He says that America feels like it is not a historic place because it lacks a lot of the trappings of a historic nation, if you will, where England has houses that are 600-700 years old that people still occupy. America doesn't really have that. Its historic buildings, most of them are gone. Its historic landscapes, if not preserved, become parking lots and Walmarts and become parts of a landscape that is ubiquitous across the country. A town in Pennsylvania could look like a town in Indiana, and a town in Indiana could look like a town in North Carolina, so on and so forth, because there are these things that make the American landscape so ubiquitous to itself. And that is why a sense of history in place, and thus memory, as we've been talking about, is radically important to not only the understanding and the importance of a place, but its preservation. Our memory, in essence, the memory and association people make with places leads them to want to preserve and protect it. And Dave Glassberg talks a little bit about this and saying that because there is such a placelessness in America, there is a sort of divide and a disassociation with modern life in the past because it does not feel like there has been a past in a place because it is new and modern and exists in a modern setting. that people don't interact that often with history. And I think that is sort of changing now that mobility is such a big thing still, and historic preservation is getting a lot more funding, so on and so forth. But Glassbrook still makes a good point in saying that a lot of people feel that there aren't enough places that make them feel connected to history, to a past, that their memory is sort of disturbed by modern life and modern aesthetic and architecture and so on and so forth. And thus, preservation holds many meanings and many importances to an American person in this example. We're talking about a lot of big things today, and I don't want to exhaust you by talking about theory and philosophy, and I don't want to exhaust you talking about preservation either, and we're taking a big bite, but the sandwich is pretty big, if that makes sense. You know, there's a lot to chew on here and a lot to interact and engage with, so balancing this is going to be tricky, but I think introducing you, the listener, to sort of a broad sort of array of topics and leading you in certain directions of interest and study, I think, is my ultimate goal here. And I don't often come out and tell you exactly what I want to happen with a podcast. And I don't want to sort of cut myself loose and say, well, I'm only going to do a little bit of this and a little bit of that because it's too hard and I'm cutting corners. That is not really my goal here. I'm not trying to be novel exactly. I'm trying to introduce you to an understudied and I think underappreciated arena of scholarship surrounding Gettysburg specifically. Longtime listeners know I'm very fascinated with the Civil War, especially Gettysburg. It's kind of the reason I'm doing this today, not just focusing on Gettysburg, but, you know, I'm in a master's program in American studies to look at, you know, American history and the Civil War. So my ulterior motive, if you will take it that way, is to sort of plant the seeds of interests and care, you know, water that with information and sources and guiding you, the listener, to interesting information, places to look, you know, giving you things to latch onto, to look at for yourself. And I'm not trying to cut corners in saying this, but I want this to be something that catches people's interest and encourages them to look more deeply for themselves at this topic and let you sort of reap the harvest of you know, planting that seed of interest. So let's do some comparisons and contrasts here when we're thinking about what the battlefield at Gettysburg looks like today and what it's looked like throughout its history. Now, on July 1st to 3rd, 1863, what we see now at Gettysburg in 2023 is far more accurate, minus the monuments and the roads curving across the landscape, to what the battlefield would have looked like back then than what it has in the past. Now, in a book called Devil's Den, A History and Guide by Gary E. Edelman and Timothy H. Smith, Gary Edelman, of course, is the American Battlefield Trust, like, chief historian. Tim Smith, he works for the Gettysburg Foundation, if I'm not mistaken, and both were licensed battlefield guides. So they've got some good experience under their belts to have written this book. In their book here about Devil's Den, they do a lot of research on the area of Devil's Den and around Little Round Top and Big Round Top. So I'm going to use this as sort of the key contrast here of what the differences were. So the battlefield has looked very different throughout its history. After the battle, of course, it was strewn with the debris and carrion of war, you know, bodies, fallen trees, toppled over stone walls, you know, breastworks were thrown up, trees cut down, you know, garbage from, you know, ammunition boxes from soldiers, whatever, you know, was laying across the battlefield. So that already looks very different from what we're familiar with today, and it's hard to imagine, you know, what this battlefield would have looked like after the battle, even without the bodies, first and foremost, but then, you know, add that to it, and it's more complicated to sort of understand what it really looked like. But after that, let's say it's 1920 and you're a visitor to Gettysburg, what would the battlefield look like? Around the early 1900s to 1930s, there was a trolley line that went around the battlefield, especially around the area of Devil's Den, the triangular field just behind Devil's Den, Little Round Top, those big areas of the battlefield, had a trolley line cutting through and around the landscape, disrupting the natural look and feel of the place. There was a restaurant and like little hut on the slopes of Little Round Top and Big Round Top. There was a picture gallery. There was all sorts of sort of disruptive, industries on the battlefield around this time period. Roads are being put in, monuments being erected, but I think, like I had mentioned, the most disruptive are these stores that are being put up, or these tourist sites. There was an amusement park sort of adjacent or on parts of the battlefield in that area. So now let's think about like the 1980s or the 1990s when the film Gettysburg was filmed on parts of the battlefield at Gettysburg. They filmed parts of the movie at and around Devil's Den. The triangular field is choked with trees for the most part, instead of what it was at the time of the battle and what it is today, which is far more accurate. And you can see that in the film. And actually, the reenactors did a lot of damage to some of the stone walls and fences that were around the triangular field, set up to sort of mark the historic, farmsteads and whatnot. So behind Pickett's Charge, where some of the Union lines would have been, was swallowed by a young-growth forest. Trees sprouted between the rocks at Devil's Den, and this was sort of the status quo for quite a long time, and even by the time when the National Park Service was working with the then Gettysburg Military Park in the 70s and acquired as the Gettysburg National Military Park, they had barely sort of gotten underway the projects that they wanted to undertake towards, cleaning up the battlefield, using July 1st through 3rd as a sort of marker. And in the book Gettysburg Contested, Brian Black, who was a former professor of mine, talks about a lot of this stuff and how it was a huge challenge for the National Park Service to sort of set forth this resource management plan and create an accurate landscape similar to that of July 1st to 3rd of 1863. But they wanted to focus on its main resource, that it is a historic landscape. This includes the landscape's balance of open farmland and woodland, the historic farm units, the lanes and traces, fences, walls, and topographic features. These are the things that were key to preservation on the battlefield, not to mention some of the historic structures that had been there at the time of the battle. So I mentioned this term historic landscape, and it's pretty much self-explanatory. It is a landscape imbued with a historical importance of just about any kind. You could think of Gettysburg National Military Park as a historic landscape. A southern plantation that has been preserved is a historic landscape. Not only the plantation itself, but the plantation grounds where the enslaved people had been living, the crop fields, whether that be cotton, tobacco, so on and so forth. The Great Plains could be considered a historic landscape and a historic environment as well. So you think about that and keeping that in mind. Gettysburg is a little different because it's a whole sort of area they're trying to keep consistent with 1863. And that's hard to do when you're balancing between not only the monuments but also public access and making that accessible. And you run into some things that you have to make concessions. The public needs to be welcome here. It needs to be accessible to as many people as they possibly can. And they've done a lot of work on Little Round Top in the past few years, something I'm very interested in as part of a historic landscape. Little Round Top, Devil's Den. This is a big sort of locale of these landscapes that are being presently preserved. And over the past 6-7 years, they've done a lot of really great work to Little Round Top to make it look as accurate as possible to 1863. And just recently, I think I've mentioned it previously in the podcast, that they're doing a lot of work to sort of correct the former use of Little Round Top. So the road and the trolley line that sort of went around there, they're fixing the scars from that. For quite a long time, you could walk down parts of the front of Little Round Top without really, disturbing anything. But now they have a certain trail you walk on. They suggest, please stay on this path. We're trying to preserve the landscape and the vegetation, the rocks, so on and so forth, around this area. So be mindful of that. But right now it is closed indefinitely. As the time of recording, I believe it's still closed. As the National Park Service, does, I think they did a controlled burn recently. They are tearing up the old paths and making that not only more accessible because they're very lumpy and broken, but sort of healing the landscape around Little Round Top that has been changed due to quote-unquote preservation of the past generations of tourists and the Gettysburg Military Park or the Gettysburg Monument Association. So, you know, generations will think differently about how they're preserving a landscape. And early on, it was less about preservation, more about bringing people in to make the money. And, you know, that sounds pretty self-serving and, you know, selfish. And it is, but I don't mean to detract also from their understanding of a historical landscape, their understanding of preservation, or their understanding of the importance of Gettysburg. Because I talked about John Badger Batchelder at the beginning of the podcast about the cemetery. And John Badger Batchelder was incredibly passionate and very, very interested in protecting parts of the landscape. One of his big sticking points was the preservation and protection of the copse of trees. The copse of trees was used by the Confederate Army as sort of a landmark to target on July 3rd, as Robert E. Lee sent his last attack across the fields of what is now Pickett's Charge. And John Badger Batchelder saw that, he knew its importance, maybe conflated it a little bit for its sake of its preservation, and protected it. And now we have, if you go there, there's a wrought iron fence surrounding it that keeps people out. And unless you're invited, they very, very infrequently open it up. There's not a lot to see in there. I've seen inside of it, but still, it's kind of a cool place. But, you know, thinking of that, preserving parts of this historic landscape has always been a key component towards protecting Gettysburg as a natural space. And like I said, this is quoting the resource management list plan, from the National Park Service when they acquired it, the GMP as well. This quote, landscape's balance of open farmland and woodland, the historic farm units, the lanes and traces, fences, walls, and topographic features, they clearly set in mind what they wanted to preserve and protect. And that adds to this idea that I haven't quite brought up yet of Gettysburg as a landscape that has been memorialized, a landscape of memorialization and monumentation. You know, and we start to think then, is Gettysburg a landscape, an environment, a historic place, a historic landscape, a preserved environment, or is it a monument in itself? Has it transcended sort of these natural terms and become something wholly different? Not only because of what happened there, or the monuments that have been erected, or the roads put in for people to access it, but simply the importance we imbue into it and the things we do to it, right? So, in that sense, we think of the Gettysburg Address. Lincoln talks about the work yet unfinished, and of course in the context he's talking about the liberation of enslaved people and bringing the South back into the folds of the Union. But we can think in the same terms of Gettysburg. What is the work yet unfinished? We can't revert Gettysburg's landscape back to what it had been exactly in 1863. We can't get rid of all the monuments, can't remove all the roads and, you know, put in dirt roads instead, or remove the non-historic roads and re-erect historic houses that had been there or had not been there, take those down. We can't get rid of the McDonald's that is buttressed against the fields of Pickett's Charge and the KFC or whatever. But it calls to mind the question, and it begs the question essentially, is Gettysburg finished? And perhaps thinking of it that way and asking that question removes the nature out of Gettysburg, because we're thinking about it now as a memorial, as a monument, something that is constructed and built. But is it not, to some extent, that? You know, we are essentially, the National Park Service, in preserving the landscape, is creating something. It is a reproduction or, you know, think of it this way. When you find an old, like, medieval work of art and it's very dusty and busted up or the canvas is torn, people will hire artists and people to clean up the painting first and foremost, then hire an artist to touch up the painting, to add parts of the painting that were missing or reproduce parts of the painting that they want redone. You know, because, and then is that even the same piece of art anymore? Is the landscape of Gettysburg the same landscape? Physically, yes. But as we, you know, mold it and shape it, and we add to it or detract from it, and making it more accessible or making it more accurate to 1863, you know, are we creating it as a monument? Is it a fake place? Again, obviously, no, it is a real place. It's a physical place. The boulders, the hills, they were there at the time of the battle, the certain forests. Some of the trees are witness trees. But we're taking the nature out of it and sort of making it our own, like, art piece. But, of course, the National Park Service is big on preservation and big on protecting the natural landscape. And, of course, their whole thing is now, you know, like, leave only memories or footprints or whatever. I can't remember off the top of my head their clever little phrasing. But, you know, they're talking about the protection of the environment, the protection of natural ecosystems, which is great. And they've done this at Gettysburg for quite a long time, not only with, you know, plants, but also animals and, you know, trying to keep, you know, certain animals that would not have been there away from the battlefield to disrupt or disturb it. But other times in places on the battlefield, like McPherson's Ridge, on the first day's battlefield, there are cattle in a field that keep it, like, almost historically accurate, not only because there are cattle in the field, but because they're keeping it a field. So I've sort of strayed from my point, but we'll ask that question again. Is Gettysburg finished? Is it a monument? Is it a natural space? Or is it something wholly different? Has it transcended or retrogressed, even if you would like to think of it that way, into something entirely different from a monument, entirely different from a landscape, a historic landscape, a preserved landscape, whatever term you want to apply to it. And if it is something different, again, is it finished? Or will it only be finished once human hands are off of it and we let it return to its sort of natural state, let nature take over? And that's, of course, a very radical stance, and I'm not, you know, vouching for that. I love going into Gettysburg, and I think we should, to the best of our ability, keep it open and accessible, obviously. But, you know, it's important to think about these things. Professor of American Studies Nick Yablon writes in an article titled Land of Unfinished Monuments that living memorials such as museums and parks are increasingly preferred over statutory monuments, in part because they are open to periodical reconfiguration rather than fixed in time. Monuments can even take the ephemeral form of light projections, temporary installations, or electronic sites of commemoration. However, much of these counter-monuments escape the authoritarian tendencies of their predecessors. They also work to domesticate the rhetoric of the unfinished, anchoring it to the official subject of the monument. In bypassing the very notion of completion, they foreclose the possibility of other meanings emerging during the process of construction. As we have seen, it was in the often lengthy interval between the cornerstone and dedication ceremonies that so many 19th-century monuments exposed the nation's dominant narratives to doubt and contestation. Just as intentionally unfinished artworks or literary texts differ in their effect from those left incomplete by the death of an artist or writer, so do intentionally unfinished monuments depart from inadvertently aborted or suspended ones. Whereas the former retain control over the beholder, enlisting him or her in the official task of commemoration and thus ultimately augmenting their own power, the latter succumb to the discursive play of disparate groups, all seeking to project their own meanings onto the unfinished stone surfaces. So the article is about 19th century monuments that were unfinished or became finished, but I really wanted to hone in on sort of that idea of unfinishedness and reconfiguration. I had asked, is Gettysburg finished? And if it isn't, we ask this, is it worth finishing? As Yablon says here, it's the part of living memorials that is so influential or important is that they can be reconfigured over time. Because Gettysburg is sort of a living space, a place of memory, as well as history, but that memory being almost more important than the actual effect there, is that it can be reconfigured, it can be reshaped, it can be changed and reformed, just like memory can. And perhaps it's memory that influences our ability and our desire to reconfigure a place. Gettysburg has been reconfigured over and over, time and time again. Before the battle, it was just a country town. It was refigured by the battle into a landscape of destruction and death. And in our attempts to commemorate it, it was reformed into a tourist attraction, a place to come get relics, to see a piece of history. But also, nature in its own way was reconfiguring, reforming Gettysburg to take over. And now we, in the era of the National Park Service, they are reconfiguring, reshaping the battlefield into that of factual memory. And in essence, as weird as that sounds, they're taking the facts best as they can and reshaping the battlefield to look what it did in 1863. But a lot of that is also influenced by memory, how people remember what the battlefield looked like, how it was. We remember that the battlefield was changed very greatly in the 20th century by tourism and people just setting things up on the battlefield because there was no oversight, protective, you know, park service adjacent entity that was stopping these things from happening. I know that sounds like I've just sort of spat a bunch of words at you, and I'm trying my best to make it make sense, because it makes sense to me. So the struggle there is just finding the best way to phrase it. So think about it this way. You have a memory of a fifth birthday when you were a kid. The farther away you get from that birthday, the less and less you are to remember it exactly. But does that really matter? To some people, yes. But sort of, memory is like wine. We're going on a new metaphor here. Memory is like wine, in which sometimes, even though it fades over time, right? The farther you get away from it, the more it ages. Sometimes the more important or the more sentimental, the better these memories get. Perhaps not because they are so accurate or you remember every detail of something, but because they matter to you. And if Gettysburg is a part of our memory, and it matters to us, the more time goes on, perhaps even the more reconfiguring we do, even to make it more accurate, it matters to us more as time goes on. And that, in essence, is sort of the importance of leaving something unfinished, or the idea of being unfinished. Will there ever be a finished Gettysburg? Probably not, and that's probably for the better. Having it be unfinished, having work yet unfinished, is important. Think of it like Francis Fukuyama's The End of History and the Last Man, or something to that effect, in which he argues that, quote-unquote, history is over because the great struggles have all come and gone. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the conflict between capitalism and communism was like the last great real struggle in defining history. Is like, what's the point then after that? What takes over? And he talks about and explains more about what is important after that. But just think of that, like, what is important after something is finished and it's come to its totality and it's done? For a work of art, the finished product, right, is important. You have the finished product. But it never really is finished because it will continually be interpreted, taught, understood in different ways and mean different things to different people. It is something to be interpreted. In Gettysburg, its history is much the same. It will continue to be reconfigured, reshaped, reinterpreted over time as time goes on, and the memory of that will change. People's memory of Gettysburg will be different as time goes. It's different now from what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I think that is what's really, really powerful. I know I've rambled a lot this episode, and I promised a lot more than I think I really got across. And again, like I said, I wasn't trying to cut corners here, but I wanted to present some information and then some, to use this term, philosophy. Whether it really is philosophy or not, that's up for you to decide. But I ask big questions, and perhaps I don't answer some. And the ones I do answer, hopefully you're convinced by those answers. But I wanted to encourage you, the listener, if you're in your car, at home, wherever you are, to think about these questions. And if you care about Gettysburg, even just a little, I think it's important to think about these things. If you care about Gettysburg a lot, like I do, I think it's important to engage in the conversation. When we think about memory, when we think about memory at Gettysburg, and we interact with these big ideas I've been bringing up, Gettysburg as a memorial, Gettysburg as a historic landscape, what it means to be unfinished and reconfigure and reshape things. To engage in those things is to engage in the conversation we're having with the landscape, with preservation, with memory. And I know that all sounds very Inception, meta, dream within a dream, but I think it's important to have these conversations. I think it's important to be involved in them and to treat them as a collaborative process. Because while the National Park Service takes care of Gettysburg and it may hire contractors and it has its own 100, 300 employees or however many at Gettysburg, it is the people who imbue Gettysburg with a sense of meaning. While the National Park handles all the logistics and the information and the pamphlets, it's the people who come there, the people who care, the people who have memories and want to think about Gettysburg in not only its historic sense, but its sense as a cultural place, a place of memory. It's us who imbue importance to insert our memory and ourselves into the conversation is not a bad thing. It doesn't matter if we're not experts or academicians or, you know, national park rangers. What matters is that we are contributing something. By even just thinking about it, or telling someone about it, or talking about it, or going to Gettysburg and engaging with it, writing about it, anything, you know, it's important to have your voice heard, because that is the essence of memory. It's the essence of even what the National Park Service does, if we want to view it that way. National Park Service preserves important places to us, whether that be historic or environmentally, whatever. But they keep it not just because it's cool to have, but because it is for us to learn from, to interact with and engage with, to be in conversation with the landscape, with the history. So hopefully I have made you think about things that you'll go out there and tackle and deal with and talk about and be interested in and write about and make your own podcast episode about, or just go to Gettysburg and think about these things. Because that, as I have said, doing that is contributing. And we all have the right and the ability to contribute. So thank you all for listening today. I hope this has been, at the very least, a little bit interesting. As always, I'm your host, Joe. This has been Days of Yore, a history podcast. And I hope you all have a good holiday season. Merry Christmas. Celebrate whatever you celebrate. Eat good, take care, drive safe, everyone.